Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The team at the Investigators and Burning Mountain Productions would like to remind you that persons associated with crimes or potential wrongdoing discussed on this episode are presumed innocent until proven otherwise in a court of law or administrative action.
Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon.
I'm Todd McComas.
And I'm Jessica Knoll. And we are
the Investigators.
Try to catch me howling at the moon.
Welcome back to all our partners in crime. We hope you had a crime-free week. And if you did not, we hope that everyone is okay and that you have the right investigators on the case.
And if you don't, hey, reach out to us.
Indeed. And Jessica. You went on a little trip, a little unusual trip that people might be interested in.
Well, I don't know if you would call it unusual, Todd. I mean, it's to each his own. Every year, we go on a girls' trip, my mom, my daughter, and I. And we always go somewhere that's relatively within a couple hours and somewhere one of us hasn't been before. So my mom has never been to Hocking Hills, Ohio. But even better than that, she loves Bigfoot. I'm a fan of Bigfoot. My daughter, not so much. She's not a believer, but she enjoys the trips.
Is that where Bigfoot lives?
So I planned this trip this year around the Bigfoot Festival.
Oh, see, this is what I'm talking about. That's not something that everybody does.
Right. So, and it's centered around the area that he has been known to frequent and live. And there were Bigfoot experts, Bigfoot fanatics, Bigfoot dressed up. I will, for our listeners, I will post some social media photos just so you can see us with Bigfoot.
Now, are you a Bigfoot believer?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, what is the harm in believing in things? I think it's fun to believe in something, especially things you can't see. You know, I'm a big fan of Mothman. Went to the Mothman Festival in Point Pleasant, West Virginia last year, ran the 5K. I just think, you know, the paranormal and supernatural and these creatures that people have documented seeing or are searching for. I just think it's nice to believe in something that you can't see.
That's the beautiful thing about it, I think. And my buddy Stuart Huff, that you know, he got me on this train about finding the beauty in things that other people are into that you might not be, or even an opposite, totally opposite belief system or whatever. Like, finding the beauty within their belief is something that I struggled with a little bit at first. But like, I'm a believer in the paranormal, so I'm pretty open-minded to crazy, creepy stuff. But Bigfoot's one of those things where no one's ever really captured a good image or any of these things of versus UFOs with all this stuff coming out now. But isn't it beautiful that someone could believe in something that we really have no evidence to prove it exists? Isn't that beautiful? And we went and talked to this Bigfoot enthusiast one time.
I thought you were going to say you went and talked to Bigfoot one time.
Well, right away, he said this one beautiful thing. And Stuart asked him, hey, what would you say to anyone that was to say to you, there's never been evidence of Bigfoot, there's no way Bigfoot exists? And he just said, I'd say that person ain't spent enough time in the woods. And I was like, that's beautiful. Like, isn't that beautiful that Bigfoot lives in people's hearts?
I have a Bigfoot shirt on right now from Hocking Hills.
I love it. I love everything Bigfoot. I mean, I want him to be real, or her. I'm assuming there's he and hers. I would love that there's something like the ocean. I get there's parts of the ocean we haven't explored yet, and they're always discovering new species down there. Wouldn't it be cool if we one day discovered this whole species above ground? We definitely need to go on a Bigfoot, not hunt, because I'm not going to be out there with a rifle looking to kill Bigfoot. I want to go out on like a Bigfoot investigation, if you will. Like, I want to go out and I want to lay out recorders, see if we can capture the sound and see if we can find some broken limbs and stuff with maybe a little bit of hair on. Whatever you do when you go on a Bigfoot expedition.
Yeah, and look for footprints. And I know the area that I'm talking about where this festival was. We can go there. And I even got one of those. It looks like a little miniature baseball bat, but apparently you hit the tree with it and it calls for Bigfoot. Oh. I don't know what it speaks to them. So I'm a little leery of using it. My mom had her own special call for Bigfoot. She would go, woo, 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 woo. I'm like, I don't know what that is. Like, what are you doing? Like, I don't know what kind of Bigfoot is going to come to
Bigfoot that. Bigfoot might be like, don't go over there.
Yeah. That's not. I also got a Bigfoot noise. I also got a Bigfoot sound thing. So I have different sounds for Bigfoot. So we'll be ready to go. And I'm just going to say right now, listeners, stay tuned.
Nice.
But enough about big hairy beast. And no, I'm not talking about you this time, Todd.
I am a big hairy beast. But yes, enough about me and my friend Bigfoot. Everyone needs to grab a shovel because we're getting ready to dig into this week's case. This investigation begins in a city known as the Gateway to Hell's Canyon, the deepest river gorge in North America. A city named after explorer Meriwether Lewis, who was one half of Lewis and Clark, because it was founded on ground they discovered. This case begins in Lewiston, Idaho. And no city would exist if not for the bravery and fortitude of the explorers who refused to accept the boundaries others had laid before them. Well, the same could be said for this show, because just like a city, our episodes are built on ground discovered by fearless explorers. Explorers of truth. And this case is no exception. So let's read you into it.
On August 31st, 1976, around 11 p.m., a 24-year-old mother picks up her daughters from their grandmother's house and heads home. Sometime after her arrival, things take an unexpected turn, and according to her husband, she walks out of the house with nothing, storming off and leaving behind her car and her two young daughters.
One of her daughters remembers seeing her father hit her mother and seeing him pick her up and put his hands around her neck before carrying her out of sight. This was the last time she ever saw her mother.
Her husband drops the kids off at their aunt's house the following day. He tells her that their mother has run off and he's going to look for her. After he leaves, she calls the Lewiston police and reports her sister missing.
2 years later, on August 27th, 1978, two hunters near Findlay Creek in Oregon come across the skeletal remains of a woman who's wearing red polyester pants, which is what the young mother in this case was reported wearing the night she disappeared.
They immediately report it to the sheriff's office, who labels their investigation into the Findlay Creek Jane Doe's death as murder.
Unfortunately, their investigation yields nothing of value. They're unable to confirm the identity of this Jane Doe, and the coroner's office is unable to identify her cause of death. So nearly 12 years later, after her remains were discovered, this Jane Doe's case is closed and the state of Oregon orders that her remains be cremated, a decision that would later play a major role in this investigation.
This is Patricia Lee Otto's story. Patricia, who went by Patty, was a mother to two beautiful young daughters. two daughters who have since traveled a long and grueling road to learn who their mother was and what happened to her. One of her daughters, Suzanne Timms, who was just 3 years old when her mom vanished, shares what they were able to discover about the woman who brought them into the world and then was all too quickly taken from them.
When she started dating my father, she was a 16-year-old girl, and she was babysitting and cleaning house for him. He had a girlfriend that had five children. She was young and beautiful and came from a very good family. She was outgoing and talkative and smart in school. When she graduated from high school at the age of 18, she married my father, who was in his 30s and divorced at that time, so a much older man. And my sister and I were born right away. My sister was born in 1971 and I was born in 73. So her life revolved around caring for us girls. And I only have pictures to show you what kind of mother she was, but my mom has so many pictures of us. She wanted to show us off. She was so proud of us. She was just a wonderful mother and a fun person to be around.
This is what Suzanne and her sister were eventually able to learn about their mother, which wouldn't come until much later in life. Up until then, they grew up with a much different picture of who their mother was, a picture they weren't allowed to paint for themselves. For much of their lives, the only picture Suzanne and her sister had of their mother was painted by someone else, someone who had something to hide.
So because I was so young, I don't remember anything about my mom actually caring for me, sadly. But you would think growing up, I would learn who she was, but that was a forbidden topic. So if I saw a picture of Patty and I was like, is that my mom? It would just be quietly put away. And, you know, we just don't want to talk about that. And I'm so sorry. And we can't talk about that. And I later learned that my father had forbidden my family from even talking about my mother because he could hold visitation over, you know, family members to say, if you're going to bring Patty up, your visits won't happen. So my grandparents weren't allowed to speak about my mother. My aunts and uncles weren't allowed to speak about my mother. And, you know, when her birthday and Mother's Day came around, they didn't honor her in any way because they weren't really allowed to. Somebody that is going to up and abandon her children, which is how I believed my whole time growing up, that my mother ran off with this other man and she never wanted to be a mother. So I grew up with this hatred of my mother, thinking this woman abandoned us and abandoned my father and left him just crying and, you know, drinking his sorrows away. I think it's really interesting that as a child, I think we were moved from one family to the next so quickly. So initially we were with my mom's sister for several months and I just kind of acclimated that that's going to be my new home. And then when my dad was upset with that situation, he moved us to his sister's home. And I acclimated really quickly. I'm like, okay, I have a new mom now. And I immediately started calling my aunt my mom. I had no problem doing that, but my dad was not replaced. It was mom, and then I would call him Uncle Bud. He was not my dad. I don't think I really realized what was happening until I was like 11 or 12. And then I start asking, Natalie, nobody's even mentioned mom for like 10 years. Where's our mom?
That question would haunt Suzanne and her sister into adulthood and will become the catalyst of their own investigation into their mother's disappearance. And following a series of tragic events in her life that would bring Suzanne to her knees, and when she felt too emotionally battered to continue her search for answers in her mother's case, she received a sign. A sign that swiftly lifted her back to her feet and introduced a new question and a face staring back at her, her own face, and a question she knew must be answered.
In 2006, that's when my sister dies in her accident. And it's my sister and her husband and my 12-year-old nephew and a 12-year-old friend. My boys were supposed to go on that trip, and at the last minute, I said no for the first time in my life. Can't explain why other than that God intervened. And I'm able to keep my children at least for a few more years, because then 5 years after that, I did lose my son, Isaiah. I haven't had time to look at this case. I don't have the mental capacity or the energy to be looking into an investigation for a missing body when it's like one trauma after another trauma. I go through this terrible divorce, then I have this move, then I lose my sister, then I lose my son. In July of 2021, I'm just scrolling through my Facebook randomly and I come across that Finley Creek Jane Doe image and I'm like, who drew me? This is a pencil drawing of me. And then I look and realize this is an unidentified woman. I read the description and it 100% describes my Caucasian, blonde, short mother wearing red pants and a white blouse, which is exactly what she's wearing. And I'm looking at her face and my face and I'm like, do I look like my mother? What? How is this possible?
Okay, you've been read into Patty's case and you've heard from her daughter, Suzanne. Now it's time to join us in the war room so we can take a deeper dive into what we know about her case. And trust me when I say, this one is complicated.
Because it is so complex, let's take a quick trip down Patty and her husband Ralph's timeline. That'll eventually lead us to her case timeline.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Their story began, according to Suzanne, in 1966, when her father, Ralph Otto, meets a woman named Bonnie. By 1968, a 16-year-old Patty starts babysitting for the couple. 2 years later, Ralph marries Patty. But that same year, something else allegedly happens.
A woman whose brother married Ralph's only sister was allegedly raped by Ralph in his home. 2 weeks after he had married Patty.
And by 1971, their daughter Natalie is born. And in 1973, her sister Suzanne makes her entrance into the world. But the joy of welcoming two daughters wouldn't be enough to hold the marriage together, and things would begin to take a tumultuous turn for the family.
In December of 1975, Patty allegedly ends a heated encounter with Ralph by firing a .357 revolver twice inside their house. Afterwards, she moves in with her sister, Alice, and takes the girls with her. 1 month later, she gets her own apartment, and by spring of 1976, Patty files for divorce and begins dating a local man named Randy.
But by May 1976, Patty moves back in with Ralph. And we'll get to what happened after that move once we get to the case file and statements. But for now, let's stick with Patty's last movements that we know of. On Tuesday, August 31st, 1976, Patty writes her last check for $9.63 to Avon. This was also the last day she's seen wearing red slacks and a white shell blouse while she's at class at Valley Business School. She leaves class early around 9 p.m. She meets up with her sister Alice and then goes to her mom's house and picks up her two daughters.
Around 10:30 p.m., Ralph goes to a local watering hole called Van's Club, looking for a guy who works there, Randy, Patty's love interest, hoping to catch Patty with Randy. He walks into the bar armed with his .357 revolver. But when he asks the bar owner, he's informed that Randy no longer works there. When the owner asks him what he wants with Randy, Ralph tells him it's personal.
Meanwhile, Patty leaves her mom's house at 11 p.m. and is home with Ralph and their two daughters between 11 p.m. and midnight when an argument ensues regarding where she's been. Now, according to Ralph's initial story to police, Patty went to the spare bedroom, someone outside honked a horn, and then she was gone by the next morning.
But according to his brother Ray, Ralph told him and his wife Dolores that Patty slept in their camper that night, and when he awoke, she was gone.
According to Patty's sister and brother-in-law, Patty's daughters remember that night, and they witnessed something entirely different. They said 5-year-old Natalie told them her dad had helped her mom sneak out of the house. And as we mentioned in our initial overview, 3-year-old Suzanne remembers her dad hit her mom, and her mom hit her dad, and then her dad picked her up and put his hands around her neck and carried her out of sight.
So Ralph has told different people different stories about the events leading up to Patty's disappearance. That's a huge red flag for any detective. And as our examination continues, you'll find it was also a huge red flag for Detective Tom Saline. As a former detective, I can tell you that I would definitely know at this point Ralph has something to hide. Something happened during that window of time he doesn't want others, especially law enforcement, to know. And when you realize the last person to see your missing person is giving different people different accounts of their time with your missing person, and that their 3-year-old daughter says she witnessed a violent encounter between them during that time, that person immediately becomes your primary suspect and the focus of your investigation. And so begins the game of cat and mouse between Detective Tom Saline and Ralph Otto.
So now we've gotten to the moments leading up to Patty's disappearance. Let's go to the following day when Alice says Ralph asks her to watch the girls while he searches for his missing wife around 2 p.m. She says he's looking for his gun at that time. And at 6 p.m., Alice says she goes back to his house for clothes for her nieces. And at that time, she says Ralph is passed out with the .357 revolver, and she removes it for his safety.
However, according to both Bonnie and Ralph, Ralph doesn't search for Patty while Alice watches the kids for him. Instead, Ralph picks up Bonnie to go shopping between 4 and 5 p.m., and afterward, they have dinner with her family from 7 to 10 p.m. Ralph then stays with her that night and allegedly tells Bonnie that Patty is gone and isn't coming back. Allegedly so upset, he appears sick and unable to eat. And after staying up all night, Bonnie and Ralph have breakfast and she gives him a ride to his car the following morning.
So where was Ralph Otto on September 1st, 1976, the day following Patty's disappearance?
Great question. Because Ralph's story about searching for Patty is immediately proven untrue by the timeline of events provided by Bonnie for that day. And after Ralph is confronted by Bonnie's account, he confirms it. So now if you're Detective Saline, your primary suspect has admitted to you he never bothered to go looking for his missing wife and instead took advantage of his sister-in-law's generosity to spend that time with his ex. He's caught him in lies about significant events, and he's demonstrated a lack of concern for his missing wife. Motive and opportunity are strong with this one, Jessica. He either doesn't care if his wife never returns, or he knows she will never return. Either way, Ralph is withholding crucial information, and Detective Saline knows it.
And we're only on day two at this point. So on to day three, September 2nd. Alice reports her sister missing at 11 p.m. to the Lewiston Police Department. And here are some timeline notes to jot down in your investigator's notebook. These notations are according to Suzanne's investigation. Also on September 2nd, Ralph's mother allegedly speaks with Ralph at his house. He asks to put his .357 in safe keeping, but he can't find it. Holster is there, but there's no gun. And if you remember, that's because Alice had already removed it earlier. And then on the next day, September 3rd, Ralph is nowhere to be seen.
And by that, we mean police were not able to account for his whereabouts, which is 3 days after Patty disappeared. So who knows? Maybe that was a good day to get rid of some stuff he didn't want lying around anymore, like some old records or clothes he no longer wears or his dead wife, you know, stuff like that.
And I can only imagine Detective Saline's curiosity about that day, because the next day, Patty's father tells him he believes Ralph is responsible for Patty's disappearance and that his son-in-law is, quote, mentally deranged. And that same day, September 4th, an officer is called to Ralph's home to pick up his guns so he cannot kill Randy. Ralph gives the officer a double barrel shotgun, muzzle loader, 22 rifle with a scope, and 38 caliber special bullets in a wooden box with two holsters. On September 5th, Alice shares her concern with police that she also thinks Ralph killed Patty and that she's probably on the property.
Now, if this was a movie, this is the part where we'd all say, well, this Ralph guy ain't the killer. We're only 15 minutes in and everything and everyone points to him. You're not fooling me that easy, Martin Scorsese. And we start looking for another character to earn our suspicion because we've watched enough cop thrillers to know directors always throw a red herring at us early in the story. But we aren't directors. And this is not a movie. This is real life and a real investigation. And in real life investigations, detectives pray to the crime gods for things to be this obvious this early. Because even though you have to stay open-minded to other possibilities, you now have a clear and focused path for your investigation to follow. So, in the spirit of Lewis and Clark and our own exploration into this new territory, let's refer to this path as the Ralph Otto Trail. Like the Oregon Trail, but the Ralph Otto Trail. Because it doesn't lead to Oregon. This trail leads us.
Okay. Yeah, you're rambling, Todd. Let's move on, shall we? On September 7th at 4 p.m., Detective Tom Saleen and Sergeant Rigney head over to Ralph's house to interview him about Patty's disappearance, but he's not home. While they're waiting for him, they see a large tarp in the yard. Now, suspecting that this tarp could be useful for transporting a body, they look for blood and hair. However, it had rained recently and the tarp was wet. The only thing they noticed was two spots of red paint that matched the color of the recently painted fence. When Ralph gets home, they ask him about the tarp and he tells them he had used it on the roof and that he had cleaned it by hosing it off. He says he laid it in the yard to dry, but then it rained.
That is totally like a scene you'd expect to see in a movie. The detectives go to the house to question the husband about his wife's disappearance and they find a giant tarp airing out in the yard. I mean, come on. Scenes like that make the hair on the back of our neck stand up for good reason. Now, imagine it's not a scene in a movie and you're the real life detectives who make this real life discovery. It's moments like this that make me wish I had not retired.
Well, then this will really make you wish for one more day of sitting across from prime suspect. They take Ralph into the Lewiston police station for questioning at 5 p.m., and they read him his rights before starting their questions. Here are some snippets from that recorded interview to jot down in your notebooks. Ralph comes home at midnight, says he was drinking, but wasn't drunk. When Patty gets home with their two daughters, she tells him to go to hell because he'd been drinking. And to quote Ralph, "Oh yeah, I always drink." She took the girls to the bedroom and put them to bed and went to hide the liquor. He says he doubts the girls were asleep when they came home. She tells him she's 24 and he's 42 and she can have anybody she wants. He says, "Well, does this mean a divorce?" And she said, kind of looks that way. He then tells her he's going to kill the little fucker, referring to Randy, the man she dated, and had already told Ralph she'd slept with since they'd been separated. He assumes she'd been with him that night, too. He says he went to bed and also says that he filed for divorce in January 1976 prior to this while they were separated, and he went to his lawyer today to reinstate that divorce filing.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Here's part of the interview Jessica and I want you to hear for yourselves. We only have the transcript of the interview, so we're going to reenact it for you. I'll be playing the part of the detective, and Jessica will play the part of Ralph Otto. The dialogue is straight from the transcript. Some of the lines from the narrator, however, have been added for exposition and some for dramatic effect. We'll begin with the scene heading or slug line as the camera begins with a wide shot. Exterior, a small municipal police department. Day. Three police cars are parked outside the modest building. An American flag whips in the wind. Every few seconds, the carabiner attached to the flag's rope clangs against the metal pole. A soothing rhythm. Cut to interior interview room. Moments later, a detective sits at one side of a table. He's incredibly handsome. He's 52, but looks like he's in his late 30s. His eyes display experience.
You mean crow's feet?
And they're super blue, which makes him look even more handsome and younger than described before. Across the table from the incredibly handsome detective sits Ralph Otto, the main suspect in his wife's disappearance. He's disheveled. He looks like he hasn't slept in days. He looks the part, a man struggling to hang on to a secret. And for some reason, he sounds like a woman. The incredibly handsome detective that doesn't look his age begins his line of questioning. Let's go into this Randy Benton thing a little bit, Ralph. I called you at home last Saturday or Sunday. I made a report on it, and you told me at that time that you were going to shoot Randy because, in your words, he had fucked your wife?
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
And then Sergeant Curran and myself came down to your residence Sunday afternoon, and at that time, you told us you were going to murder Randy.
Yes.
You were going to shoot your wife in the gut and him in the brisket. Is that right?
Yes.
And today, when Sergeant Rigney and I was at the residence, you said you were looking for your .357 because you were going to kill Randy. Would that be right?
Yes.
Are you telling me now that it's your intention to kill Randy Benton?
I don't have to answer that.
No. No, you don't. If you don't want to, you don't have to. I was just asking you if that was your intention.
I gave you all of my guns that I can find.
But you're still looking for your other one, your pistol?
Yes, the pistol.
The gorgeous detective strokes his long, chiseled jawline. He knows if Ralph had an attorney, they'd be screaming at him to shut his mouth right now because he's making himself sound guilty as shit. Ralph tells the Captain America-looking detective that he didn't sleep at all after he went to bed, leaving Patty alone. The detective asks how Patty left.
Well, apparently she got up and left. And as far as I know, she was dressed.
Ralph would go on to say that this would have been about an hour after she got home with their daughters. The detective's hair is something to be admired. He continues to dig deeper. Is it like her to leave her kids like this?
No. No, it's not likely she would leave her kids.
Ralph had said previously that someone was honking a car horn outside when she left. The detective asks Ralph if he knows who that person was.
No, I didn't even look. I didn't have any idea what it was, or I just figured it was, you see, I have an awful lot of trouble with that goddamn park below me, and I couldn't tell for sure where that horn was coming from there, or the street, or down there.
Ralph adds that he didn't hear Patty go out the door, and only assumed she left at that time. Ralph says he didn't speak to her again that night and has not seen her since.
The next morning, Ralph tells the very average-looking detective, who definitely looks 52, that he looked in her bedroom and the other bedroom. And then he went downstairs and looked in on the kids who were still sleeping. He says he then went outside to feed the rabbits and their dog, Duke. He says he looked around the house and even inside the camper, but she wasn't anywhere. And the frumpy detective asks Ralph more about the next morning.
What did you do?
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember what I did. I got the kids up and fed them breakfast around 9 o'clock, called her mother, I think I called her mother or her sister. I called somebody and told them, and they asked where she was at, because I figured that was where she would be. That's when Alice came and got the girls. And then Ralph says he went to the bar Vans Club with a gun looking for Randy.
If Randy would have been there, would you have shot him?
Yep. But fortunately for Randy, he wasn't there. Then, he says, he drove to the bar, the Winchester Club, thinking Patty might be there. The out-of-shape detective asks Ralph about the couch cushion that was missing from his home when they were inside. Ralph says it needed repair.
The detective, who's been too busy to hit the gym like he used to and plans to start up again next week, clearly wants to lock Ralph into a story about the missing couch cushion so he can either account for why it's missing or prove later that Ralph is once again not being truthful.
The detective embarrassingly sucks in his gut and asks Ralph about why she was sleeping in a different room. Ralph says,
"We sleep together. We have a very good relationship. Our sex life is good, and, you know, it's good. I eat her, meow, and the whole deal."
"Pardon?"
"I eat her, meow, and the whole deal."
"Okay. Tell me this, Ralph. Why do you think she would want to leave you?"
"Because I'm too old for her, and I drink too much."
"Are you an alcoholic?"
"Yes."
"I'm going to tell you, while I've got this tape on, I've told you every time you've told me that you were going to murder Randy that you cannot do that. And anything you want done, have it done through us. You want to sign a complaint against him for doing something? You do that and handle it that way. You can't go around murdering people." "Do you have anything to say to that, Ralph?"
"I can't go around murdering people."
"That's right."
"Yes, I understand that. I mean, that's just not right."
"Okay, but apparently you want to murder Randy?"
"Yes. I know he knows something about this. I know he does. I know he does."
"Do you have any reason to believe that, Ralph?"
"Sure. Just good instinct. She's been gone too many times at night. I ask her if she's been all for it, all for whoever, her time elements or whatever you call it."
The incredibly sexy detective ends the recording shortly after this part. But because of conversation that takes place after he stopped the recording, he starts it again to get those statements on the record.
"Ralph and I had a short discussion after I turned the tape off, and I asked him if he, in fact, had killed his wife, Patricia Otto, and he advised, hell no. He at that time advised me he was going to blow his brains out. I asked Ralph why, and Ralph indicated, because she has no use for me. Would that be about right, what we said, Ralph?"
"Yes."
Okay, end scene. Cut. Now I'm going to have to go back and post and edit out a few inaccuracies Jessica ad-libbed when she butted in as narrator, but that's how this interview went down. Again, the dialogue was straight from the transcript, and I have some thoughts. Ralph did himself absolutely no favors in this interview. He managed to paint a very clear motive for killing Patty, while also having the opportunity to kill Patty and ample time to hide her body. After this interview, we can clearly see that Ralph felt his wife Patty had fallen out of love with him and was intending to leave him and file for divorce. And after he clearly tells the detective he planned to shoot both Patty and the guy he believes she's seen, we know he wasn't too happy with the idea of her leaving. Unfortunately, even though he continues to tell him things that point to his guilt, he never crosses the line to make a usable admission to having harmed Patty to the detective. So now you could really begin to sense the frustration Detective Salim must have been experiencing at this point in his investigation.
After their 30-minute interview with Ralph at the police station, detectives drive him back to his house and ask him to show them the secret room in his basement, a small room that was concealed by a piece of paneling. He complies, and inside they find a hot water tank, some pumps to a jet boat, and some other miscellaneous items that were of no concern. Okay, you're a detective, and there's a secret room in the basement. What are you hoping to uncover, and do you think it's still there now?
I mean, a secret or hidden room is juicy stuff, right? And as a detective, you can't wait to get inside that sumbitch. Unfortunately, they didn't find anything remarkable inside, but the fact that it even exists begs the question, why did this dude feel he needed a hidden room in his basement? But As it would turn out, people in his life were aware of this secret or hidden room, which makes it a little less secret and a little less hidden, which is how these detectives were made aware of it, right? So that leads me to think it was more of a novelty, maybe, than it was an actual place he intended to store things that no one could ever find. I mean, it was Patty's sister who told police they should look inside it, so would he keep a body there? I don't know.
Well, he did have that whole day to himself 4 days earlier. Maybe he tidied up then.
That is true. So if that room still exists today, would it be worth searching again? Sure. I mean, we have science available today that we didn't have then. That's plain and simple.
So they go back upstairs and again speak with Ralph.
During this conversation, Detective Celine noticed two shell casings on the living room coffee table. One is .38 caliber and the other is .357 caliber. Ralph gives the detective permission to seize the shell casings as well as some snake shot loads and a Pacific Northwest telephone book that belonged to Patty. The phone book contained phone numbers for numerous people, which is every phone book. But this phone book had handwritten phone numbers on it that Patty had written inside the cover.
Okay, Detective McComas, what are you going to do with all those shell casings and the handwritten phone numbers?
I'm going to call every single one of those numbers and ask them what their relationship is to Patty, when they last saw or heard from her, and if they have any information that could help me find her or figure out what happened to her. Now, as for the shell casings, I'm definitely going to store those as evidence in case we need them for comparison later, like in the event her body is found and there's a bullet or shell casing found at the scene also. That's at that time. In present day, it's a little different. I would also have them examined and entered into databases that could match shell casings found at other unsolved crime scenes. That's why we love shell casings and bullets today.
Perfect. Love it. Now, according to Suzanne, here are a few things of note that occurred on September 9th, 1976, 10 days following Patty's disappearance. First, Randy Benton tells detectives he hasn't seen Patty since May. Also on that day, detectives go to Ralph's house to offer him a polygraph, but he declines. Ralph tells them the drugs he's on may affect the result. One of the detectives notes that Ralph's been drinking and advises him not to drive. And they talk further with him about the polygraph and using truth serum. But Ralph declines again. Okay, hold up. Todd, explain to me, what is truth serum? Because it sounds fictional, like one of the many, 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 many movies you're always bringing up.
All right. Now, this shit is crazy, okay? But it's true. During this era, law enforcement had a very interesting relationship with the CIA, which, as part of an effort to train certain officers at large departments as intelligence officers to track and gather intel on what they deemed as domestic terrorist organizations at their behest, the CIA offered up the use of certain tools and techniques that they were utilizing at the time. Tools like hypnotism and the use of certain psychoactive drugs referred to as truth serum were introduced to these select officers. But it didn't take long before statements made by suspects under the influence of either of these things became inadmissible in court as they discovered each technique relied on the suspect being in such a relaxed state they couldn't freely exercise their constitutional right to stop answering questions at any time. Also, while placed in such a relaxed state, they were super vulnerable to coercion and planting of false memories by the interrogator. So, truth serum, it's just one of those many archaic and ridiculously dangerous-ass things introduced to law enforcement by the always shady CIA. Just a bit of trivia to shove in your pocket.
Fascinating and also terrifying. And I'd also like to say for the record, I've always admired, respected, and trusted the CIA.
Good call. They might be listening.
Okay, back to the timeline. At 8 a.m. on September 14th, police check water tanks near Ralph's home for a body. It's later confirmed by professionals that it would have registered if a body was present in the tank. So forensics at its best in the 70s.
Indeed. On September 21st at 9:30 a.m., Ralph arrives at the Lewiston Police Department to see Detective Celine, but spoke with another officer. Ralph says to that officer he is a violent person and cannot calm himself once he is worked up. He admits to being on Valium and Thorazine and admits to having hit Patty and his ex-wife Joy on occasion. He also claimed that he hit Patty one time for leaving him at a bar. He also refused a polygraph again. And on September 23rd, Ralph's neighbor spoke with Detective Celine, saying that Ralph told her, if I did kill her, they will never find her body. And then she said he propositioned her for sex and that he was drunk and suicidal. Just another Tuesday for Ralph.
Now, almost 1 month since Patty's been missing, Ralph walks into a bar. Sounds like a joke.
It does.
But it's no joke. He had a plan. This time, it's not to kill Randy, though.
Oh, man, I love me a good cliffhanger. And I know you guys can't wait to hear about Ralph's new plan, but unfortunately, you'll have to wait a week for part two of our examination into the disappearance of Patty Otto. In the meantime, make sure you're following us on social media. There are links to all our accounts and show notes for each episode, including this one, on our website, investigatorspodcast.com. And please take time to rate the pod, write a review, and recommend it to a friend. Just one friend. I don't think that's too much to ask. But just to be sure, let me check that real quick on how to know if you're a greedy piece of shit.com. And just one friend. Nope, we're good. One friend, let him know. Oh, and please, if that one friend is named Randy, don't go around town trying to kill him, because if you do, you might have to deal with us. Because we're the investigators!
I came from the mud, there's dirt on my head. Strong like a tree, there's roots where I stand. Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon. They seem gone to sleepless night. Try to catch me howling at the moon.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.